From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In these times, we have to unify. We have to come together and send one very clear, strong, unmistakable message that acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America.
But it is a troubling time, isn't it? And it's a time of deep divisions. And we have to do everything we can to bring our country together.
Two voices from the 2016 election, President Donald Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, reacting to news of a series of pipe bombs being discovered targeting prominent opponents of President Trump's administration. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia. It's a really unique moment, except there's another unique moment almost just like it, which is around the time of 9/11, 2001, when you had all the anthrax being mailed to people. And we're trying to, you know, I'm looking at the group of targets here today. As a matter of fact, it's even being reported that way. These are all people that have, you know, are opponents of Trump. That Trump has spoken harshly about in one fashion or another in the main, most of them, and that it's being painted as if this, you know, must come from some Trump supporter because of Trump's, you know, angry rhetoric, exciting, you know, crazy people, crazy white nationalists or whatever. But while they're talking that, this comes 2 days after the New York Times, if you want to speak about something unique, the book review section, rather than reviewing books, actually publishes five stories about how Trump goes out of office, including one where he's assassinated with a Russian here to silence him because the world's about to find out he is, in fact, Putin's puppet. And when the Russian-made gun fails, the Secret Service agent pulls his gun out. The Russian thinks he's done for, and the Secret Service agent said, here, use mine. This published in the New York Times Tuesday.
Yeah. I would say that this current bomb threats and so on is like the Russiagate, a false flag. I would say this current thing is about 75%. I'm certain it's a false flag. And it's a part of the taking back the House and creating an atmosphere of extreme fear and paranoia among the electorate. I think it's going to backfire. I mean, at best or worst, whatever side you're on of this, it's going to frighten people away from the polls and people who would potentially vote for the Democrats. But it is a manifestation of a certain crisis of democracy, and as we've talked so often, a crisis of rule where the masses of people, the demos, to use the Greek word, which is the prefix in the word democracy, the demos are in rebellion against the elite and democratic rule, which in its pure form suggests that the people rule, but the people rule because they are informed by their leaders and self-informed through discourse and debate. And Russiagate and this current thing, these bombs is a way of cutting off discourse, of cutting off political debate, no matter how nasty it could become. And of course, Donald Trump is a master at ratcheting up the nasty part of it. But that's a part of discourse as well. But what we're seeing now is the elites and what we now know, or we call the deep state, trying to and forgive the this irony, trying to trump the people's will. And so, you know, there's a crisis of democratic theory, and it's always a question of could democracy of people's rule and capitalism coexist? And you know, all of the democratic theorists, including Marx and Lenin and Du Bois, the three that I just mentioned, question whether or not capitalism and democracy could work. Of course, Lenin and Du Bois said that, well, rights of the working class in the advanced capitalist countries was based upon the exploitation of colonial labor in the rest of the world.
Right.
Now, we're seeing that system collapse, and there is a crisis of democracy in the advanced countries.
Yeah, so, this is interesting because, just to interrupt for a second,
before
we get too far from the point, first with the, you know, and sort of to encapsulate all that, you know, you go to the Greek source, demos, which means people. For democracy, it's demos kriton or kraton, which is people's rule. And when you have the people in people's rule rebelling against the rule, it tells you something about the intrinsic nature of that rule. In fact, it's not a people's rule in the first place, because otherwise, it would be impossible for them to rebel against their own rule. Now you take a look at the nature of this system and, you know, of capitalism, which it is rests upon and has been inextricably, you know, uplifted, developed with imperialism, with colonialism, which is an international form of class war. It's just simply one based on geography, and sort of discrete levels of stratification, but still classes. Here's the owning class. We own your country. Here's the laboring class. We're being made to carry our stuff to the boat so that you can take it away. And that is, as we've discussed for, you know, that you brought to this conversation 2 years ago, at least now, 3 years ago, that's really the central point of contention between Trump and the deep state, which is Trump apparently looking to do some sort of, you know, recognizing or seeing that imperial retreat is necessary and trying to move towards that, and there being a deep state reaction to it. That's the reaction to the people.
And, you know, if you just follow the narrative, they're saying, in effect, that populism, which means popular or the populace, and democracy don't go together.
Right.
And therefore, the populace or the popular will has to be contained and controlled.
Right.
And what they're literally saying is, well, we don't have a problem with Trump as an individual, but he has riled up the population and turned them against our, quote, democratic institutions, including the presidency, the electoral system, the media, and so on.
Right.
And therefore, since he has riled up the population or represented the anger of the population against the elites and the institutions controlled by him, he must therefore be a fascist.
Right.
When in effect, it could be the opposite, that those who control the institutions of, quote, democracy themselves might be the real fascists.
Right.
And this might be, ironically, in embryo, an anti-fascist movement. And what I'm suggesting, and I'll stop right here, what I'm suggesting is to think clearly about this moment. Things might be the opposite of what we have generally thought them to be. And of course, you know, the reputed despicables and racist might be less racist than the people who are pointing fingers at them.
Right. Yeah, you know, there's an interesting piece at consortiumnews.com on that last point, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Where and I'll have the piece in a second, but the author of the piece points to the outreach done by the Black Panthers, the author being Colette Gator, and I guess it was originally published in The Conversation. The title is kind of self-explanatory. When Black Panthers aligned with Confederate flag-wielding working-class whites. And where it goes to is that essentially the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense looking around at building, you know, a revolutionary movement that, you know, really could be one beyond just the people that the Black Panther Party could reach. And one of the groups they found was the Young Patriot Organization in Chicago, in Hillbilly Harlem, as they called it. They were, many of them were racist. Not all of them, by the way. Although this seems, you know, sort of counterintuitive, because their organization clearly looked and was in many ways racist. They had, you know, used the Confederate flag and all that stuff, but the Panthers said, you know, we need this, and this is Fred Hampton. He wanted to form the Rainbow Coalition of working class and poor people of all races.
Right.
And so they look around and they said, if we can reach these guys, then we're way down the road.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Of course.
And then you know what happened to Fred Hampton.
Right. Of course. And you're absolutely, and I knew Fred Hampton, and I was not surprised when he made such a move, because we were in a study group together on the south side of Chicago, and the book that we were studying together was Das Kapital. So,
well, that's him. I am a proletarian. He stressed that all the time. And then just one other thing for people to keep in your mind. You're aware of this already, obviously. But, you know, the ones that that got targeted, take a look around at who survives, and then take a look at who was killed. Malcolm X, and when he was killed, for example, was almost immediately after he left the Black Nationalist perspective of the
Nation of Islam.
And started talking about Islam in general, his experience in Mecca, and wanting to come back, not abandoning struggle and organizing the Black community, but looking next to it, as we have to ally with all of these people. Bam, gone. The same Martin Luther King, of course, he always had this perspective in his organizing, but looking at organizing workers, not just Black workers, but Black workers. I mean, that's when he was organizing the sanitation workers when he was murdered in Memphis. That's exactly what he was doing. But he was talking that same thing. Unity, working class unity. Bam, gone.
And, that's right. And of course, you know, when you talk about working class unity, back then, they were calling it out-of-control populism. That Martin Luther King, by linking racism, poverty, and anti-war, was, you know, agitating the masses to go against the elites. I mean, we see the same thing today. And therefore, things must be looked at in their opposites, not what, especially not what the elite and mainstream media are saying. The other thing about this, you know, with the collapse of the system of U.S. Empire, which is a world system dominated by U.S. finance capital and the U.S. military, with that in collapse and retreat, and Donald Trump giving voice to that in contradictory ways, and we can talk about that. Donald Trump, the man with his views, and Donald Trump, the politician, especially the way he has to play it politically in the 2018 elections, who he has to appeal to to save his presidency and to prevent a House which would, for the next 2 years, create a toxic environment for him to govern in.
Right.
So
a declared goal. I mean, that's a declared goal.
Well, they said it. Even though they have this fig leaf of health care, the real content and intent of 2018 is to get a House majority that could begin something like impeachment.
Right.
But the whole point is to destabilize his presidency,
right,
which, by the way, as I read the Bob Woodward book, Fear, it was clear that it took him about a year to get control of the White House.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And by the way, the Bob Woodward book is 80%, if not more, about the debates within the West Wing about foreign policy and trade policy. And they were some, you know, vicious battles among the so-called White House staff and such.
Yep.
And the White House, again, was operating separate from the administration. That is the Secretary of Education and Housing. All of that was something else. The
yeah.
battles were for the control
foreign
of the
policy.
Direction yep. of the U.S. state in foreign policy.
Yep.
This is the key.
Yeah.
And the reaction, the Russiagate, this current thing, the fight to take back the House, is all about the U.S. empire.
Right.
Now, I would say this. There are those on the other side of Trump who recognize that imperial retreat is inevitable and necessary,
mm-hmm.
but they want to slow walk it. Donald Trump wants to fast track imperial retreat. And they are saying, the opposition, that this is too risky. They realize, or those who are rational, that this is an inevitable retreat. You see, this notion that he is a fascist, and this is a smear, and it's not based upon any scientific definition of fascism, and to make him a
Key
Mussolini
point.
Or a Hitler
right.
is so crazy,
right.
That, you know, but
right, because he ain't that, and this ain't the 30s
no.
either, by the way. It's not just
no.
who is Trump, but who are we and what are we compared to what we were 80, 90 years ago?
That's right. But see, if he were a fascist, like a Hitler, Hitler wanted to expand German imperialism. Hitler wanted to overthrow the Soviet government. Donald Trump is talking about the opposite, a retreat
That's right.
from hegemony, rather than a unipolar, a multipolar world.
Right.
He wants to do away with NATO and the World Trade Organization.
Right.
And again, you know, he and Putin are going to meet in Europe on November the 11th. For a mini summit,
yep.
where I'm certain they're going to talk about restarting nuclear arms treaties and so on.
Like a new environment for that stuff, even.
Absolutely,
I agree.
Absolutely. But, you know, this is a very, and as you put it, I mean, fictionalizing his assassination as a step towards actualizing it.
Right, that's right. Whether it encourages some nut job that now has the cover of a
mm-hmm.
public narrative started by the respectable New York Times, so it's believable that this nut job would do this all on their own, or even
yeah.
as a cover story for the other kind of nut job, somebody that's on the CIA's payroll,
yeah.
you know, that goes in there thinking they're going to get a hero's motorcade, and instead they get killed as the assassin, which is what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be far more sophisticated than that, and it would be a Hail Mary pass because
yeah, right.
it would destabilize the political environment.
Yeah,
and I think almost immediately take the political civil war to
That's
an armed
street.
Civil war
yeah,
in the United States.
Before we get there, because I want to you know flesh out 2 points that you made. For illustration, one is, you know, as they're talking about Trump as the fascist, and you mentioned the contradictions in Trump as a, you know, product of working class uprising, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have Bernie Sanders represented pretty much exactly the same thing inside the Democratic Party. Largely white. People are forgetting that now, but that was daily in the media back during the campaign, as Clinton surrounded herself with brown and black faces on television every day, any 10 people she could find. They were pointing to Bernie as being some old white Jewish guy that, you know, ain't in touch with the communities of color. So you had that element, just like Trump. Not the same, but close enough. You also had the real, economic interests driving the surprising lift of that candidate. But now if you look at the essential difference, it's the same one that shows you who's on which side right now. Because Bernie Sanders was talking about Hugo Chavez, the dead communist dictator, and getting tough with Putin and all this other stuff. And he's continued to say that. He's beaten the Russiagate drum as loud as anybody is. And so, you know, as I stand as a Bernie bot behind the Democratic Party and pointed Trump as a fascist, what exactly am I when I'm supporting the war policy, that these Democrats are supporting? So on that point, who's the fascist is pretty clear, actually. A question of war and peace. You see where that is. There's one other thing that's a part of that. You go ahead and do what you're doing, and then I'll see if we need to add this in, because there's something else that struck me.
I was going to say, a part of the problem of the left and progressive forces is a deep mistrust and distrust of white working people.
Yeah.
You know, they cannot believe that white working people would be the ones who would be in the leadership of an uprising against the establishment.
You know,
but that's precisely what is happening.
It's kind of weird. I just want to tell you on my Facebook page to illustrate the point. I can't tell you how many different people, white people, were telling me, how evil nationalism, basically, white-splaining, but as if they were social justice warriors, that pointing to some member of their family as an example of how racist white people are.
Yeah. But, you know, again, I mentioned, I think last time, Ben Bradley Jr.'s book on Luzerne County in the center of Pennsylvania, who never voted for Republican for president since 1988, and before that, since the 1930s, probably, and voted for Obama twice, but in 2016 voted for Trump. Right. The question is, how do you explain that? And that's not a middle-class suburb. It is not any of those things that are supposed to fit the Trump demographic. It's a coal mining area.
Right.
It's a deindustrialized area. It's overwhelmingly white and would be considered liberal. I mean, the fact of the matter is the so-called left and progressives distrust, have no confidence in class, and they have turned, therefore, to identity politics and really forms of anarchism, protest without any strategic or tactical vision. And they do this in isolation from what is so palpable and clear, a uprising and anger based upon class. The other thing I would say, it is so noticeable, it's almost shameful that the left no longer even talks about the unions.
Right.
And of course, the mass media, the mainstream media, has not even sought out Richard Trumka to give his opinion on renegotiated NAFTA or on TPP or on Trump's international trade policies with China and with Europe and with Canada and so on and so forth. What are workers, especially workers in industrial unions in the center of the country, what are they saying?
Well,
clearly, and this is very telling, I think, Don, you don't hear a word about the unions campaigning for anyone in the midterm elections. I'm certain they are. But the unions have not thrown all of their weight behind the Democrats, because I think the unions, at least at the leadership level, certainly the rank and file decided what they're about already, but at the leadership level, they feel at this time they have to hedge their bets. On yep. Trump and trade, they're with him.
Yep.
On some other things, maybe not. And on immigration, they are with him.
Yeah.
Because they understand how all of this fits into a global system of higher and higher profits and lower wages and greater poverty for the working class.
Yep.
And on this point, I'll stop right here. On this point, black and white workers in their thinking about the world are closer together maybe than they have been in 70 years,
yep.
maybe 60 years.
Yep.
And I would suggest to you, although it is not very obvious, black working people and the poor are part of this uprising, especially yep. in the Midwest, in places like Detroit and Flint, in Milwaukee, in these small towns, industrial towns in Ohio and other places. So, yep. I mean, we're in a full-scale rebellion.
Yep.
And I think the best thing for the ruling class to do is to find some compromise with Trump, allow him to govern, and let's get on with solving some of the problems of the country. I don't yep. think they're going to do that, however.
Well, you know, there's a great deal of latent hope, I guess.
Yes.
That was evident when we were in Cleveland in 2016. Because, yeah. you know, we've discussed part of this, this main point many times, that, you know, the so-called left was going to organize to shut down the RNC, and mm-hmm. then they accomplished nothing. There was no local yeah. actions whatsoever. Now, that means, A, they couldn't get people to come from around the country to Cleveland to do that, and B, they couldn't, or two, or whatever, they couldn't mobilize locally.
And you so remember, you want to know,
because well, here's the point. This
the
much
irony
we've said.
Of the whole thing was that a guy who was protesting, he was going to burn the American flag
and,
ended up setting himself on fire.
Yeah, yeah. But, yes, I do. This is from the RCP. But there's this point, which we haven't discussed before. Mm-hmm. And this goes to the point, then they couldn't organize people locally. Mm-hmm. Who's the people locally? 53.3% of them are black in Cleveland.
Right. Right,
okay.
In Cleveland.
There was no local protest against Trump in a black city, in essence.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So,
right.
you know, there's like, you know, an awful
but
lot
we,
of links.
When we came to Philadelphia, there were thousands marching
tens
against
of thousands,
Hillary.
Thousands here, yeah. thousands there, thousands everywhere, including inside yeah. inside the forum, the delegates yeah. themselves.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is definitely a spirit of rebellion in the air, and it's being managed by the media, by the political establishment, by everything, every cartoon that every kid was fed instead of a book when we were kids, whatever it is that's driving it. People are, you know, being driven into motion, and they're because I guess the powers that be see that that's inevitable. The people are in motion, and so now the game is to try to lead them down a dead end or in a circle, and you know, that is what we see happening when I saw evidence of it this weekend. I went to the Women's March on the Pentagon and heard Cindy Sheehan say in an interview, and which I had seen happen when it was happening, but never really clicked. Well, we decided to do this after we went to the people who organized the inauguration and the anniversary inauguration women's marches and said we wanted to make sure that they made a demand to shut down the military machine. And they said to me, Cindy, war is your issue, not ours. And so, okay, that is the condition of the leadership that's organizing these mass protests against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
War, and on the question of war and peace, they're not interested. So
yeah.
like, we're out of time. So, Tony, I'd like to continue this next week, but appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Don.
Oops. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.